accession number 18090, real one.
This is the recording of an interview with Commander Philip Francis in West Camel, Somerset, on Thursday the 19th of November, by Rodney Giesler for the Imperial War Museum Sound Archive.
Can you tell me, first of all, when were you born?
In 1908. Uh-huh. I'm an Edwardian.
You are? Great. And do you come from a naval family?
No.
What prompted you to go in the Navy? Can you remember?
Oh, I think my father just thought it was a good thing.
Yes.
He worked in London, and he realised that it was perhaps better to get away from London, and he more or less told me what to do. And in those days, we did what we were told.
He worked in the city, did he?
He worked in the city, yes.
Yes. So you went to Dartmouth at the appropriate time, did you?
I went to Dartmouth in 1922, I think. Mm. Wait a minute. Well, when I was 13, 22, that's right. And
so shortly after the move from Osborne then, wasn't it?
That's right. It was only one or two terms later. Mm. Yes, and I always remember arriving at Dartmouth. We were marched up from Sankey up to the college, and we were taken out into the front of Dartmouth. Do you know Dartmouth? Mm. We were taken out into the front, and we were shown what was written in 4 feet letters on the front of the college. And it is, quoting Samuel Pepys, I think, "It is upon the Navy, under the good providence of God, that the health, wealth, and prosperity of this country largely depends." I think I've got it right.
It's a very well-known saying, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. It was Samuel Pepys, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes, I think so.
Yes, well, that is written on the front of Dartmouth. You may not have even noticed it. It's right up at the top, and you can see it from down in the town, you know.
Which term were you in?
I was a Blake.
A Blake. Mm-hmm. And were any of your contemporaries sort of risen to prominence since then? Did you follow them through a lot?
We didn't have many. We had Michael Townsend. He became an admiral. No, we had very few who became admirals. So we weren't really very distinguished.
And then you went to sea as a midshipman, presumably, in the normal course of events?
No, I went to sea as a cadet.
Uh-huh.
In those days, they sent you to sea, and for about the first 6 months, you were a cadet. And so, but that doesn't happen now, I don't think.
What was your first ship?
Ramillies, battleship.
And was that with the Home Fleet or the Mediterranean Fleet?
That was Home Fleet. Oh, in those days we had the biggest navy in the world. And I don't know how many battleships there were, but there must have been a dozen or more in the Home Fleet alone, not to mention the Mediterranean.
And which was your main base? Was it to Portsmouth or...?
No, I think it was Devonport.
Devonport, mm-hmm.
Yes.
Have you memories as a snotty in Ramillies? Life in the gun room, what was it like?
Oh, it was tough. It was tough. I used to run a picket boat, a steam picket boat, and which was quite a responsibility. It had a crew of eight or something, and you had to steer. And if you got into trouble, like breaking the gangway, which I did once, you got beaten. And
who beat you?
Oh, the sub-lieutenant of the gun room.
Of the gun room, yeah.
Yes, that's right, yes.
And I suppose the picket boat, I mean, you were responsible for bringing the admiral on board and so on, and all the top brass, were you? Or?
Well, not when I was in Ramleys, no, but I'd, later on when I went to... Renown. Yes, I'm not certain. We were guardship at Cowes, and then I ran the barge, which was based in Renown, and I took the monarch himself from Victoria and Albert, which was the royal yacht, out to Britannia, which was at sea with its sails up and hove to, and as we were approaching, I was steering, the monarch stood up in his little sailor's hat, which he had, and he said, "Mind my paint!" And, of course, that fairly put the wind up me. I was only a little midshipman, you know. And as we got alongside, he stepped on board and he said, "Well done, my boy." And I went away feeling as pleased as anything. And that's my only sort of royal picket boat business.
What were your other duties as a midshipman in those days?
Well, you had to keep watch on the quarterdeck in harbour, and you had an officer watch, he was a lieutenant, and you had a midshipman watch, and he was the general dog's body that went away on messages and so on. And at sea, you kept watch again with a lieutenant or lieutenant commander. And your main job was to make the cocoa.
Did you move around the ship? I mean, were you in gunnery for some time? Any specialities or in the engine room? Or?
Oh, we moved around. We did periods under the sort of tuition of, shall we say, the senior engineer, and you had a watch in the boiler room and that sort of thing. Oh, yes, you were taught everything. And you'd be going a 15-inch turret and be taught about that. Oh, yes, we were taught in these big ships you had everything, you see. And you had to take sights, too. And the navigator would... check that you die properly, or teach you how to do it, really.
Of course, when you were in the boiler room, I mean, they were oil-burning ships, weren't they? You didn't have the terrors of the old coaling ship days.
I was in one coaling ship, but that was out in China, and that was only a sloop. And it was absolute hell, a coaling ship. And everything got as black as anything. How the battleships got on, I just don't know.
Because everyone had to lend a hand on coaling ship, didn't they?
Well, not everyone. And it always used to irritate people that the sparkers, those are the...
Telegraphists. Yeah.
Didn't have to, because they considered the rough handling of coal shovels and so on was bad for their touch. And the navigator, he never had to take part. And he used to go ashore and get out of the way, which we didn't like very much.
How far up the ranks did they pull people in for coaling duties?
Well, the second in command, if it was a sloop, would have been a lieutenant commander, perhaps. But he had to be there, I mean, to run things.
So he got covered in coal.
Oh, he got covered in coal as well, oh, very much so. Yes.
Tell me a bit about the gunnery, because I mean that's something you don't see nowadays in the age of missiles. I mean, what was it like to fire those big guns?
When I was not in Remedies, but I'm jumping up to the beginning of the war, I was in Repulse. I was a submariner, but I was doing my big ship time, and I was a turret officer. I was in charge of a 15-inch turret, and we used to go out and scour the Atlantic for the Deutsch, I think it was the Deutschland, and we used to load our guns and have them at the ready, and but we never fired them in anger when I was there. Thank goodness.
But you presumably had gunnery practice when you fired live rounds.
Oh, yes, yes. When you were in the turret, they didn't...
Mind the microphone.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's a bit of noise, that's fine. When you were in the turret?
When you were in the turret, it wasn't too bad. As the turret officer, you had a little slit about 4 inches long and 2 inches deep, and just to be able to look out. And that's really where the noise came in. So it wasn't very bad. And I don't think a 15-inch gun is really as bad as, shall we say, a 4-inch gun, which has much more of a crack. I, in fact, am suffering from deafness in my left ear, entirely due to a 4-inch gun, which I got too close to during practice shoots. And I was much deafer in my left ear than I am in my right. And it was due to that. But the 15-inch guns, one did put cotton wool in one's ears, but it was a sort of more of a boom than a crack, if you see what I mean.
Now, the procedure was the shell would come up the hoist from the magazine, and then you'd have what? Cordite in linen bags, didn't you, as the propellant?
That's right. The shell room, it came up on a hoist, the shell first, and then it was rammed in. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I'm getting in the way of that thing. The shell comes up first, it gets rammed in, the automatic rammer in the turret. And then the cordite comes up from the magazine, which was on the next deck. And that was put in. And everything was automatic. I mean, nothing was done by hand. The breech was closed. The breech about 3 or 4 feet long in diameter.
It was hydraulically operated, presumably.
And everything was hydraulic, yes. Yes.
And then what? You sent a signal up to the control top that the guns were ready. Was that it, or?
I must get out of there.
I mean, you didn't actually fire the guns from your position, did you?
Only if things went wrong. I think they did. In war, yes. No, all the information went to the TS, and TS was right down in the bowels of the ship. And they controlled everything. They had a thing called a Dreyer table, which Admiral Dreyer, you've probably heard of him, He invented, and that was down in the TS, which I think stood for transmitting station. And all the information went to the TS, and the control officer was up in the foretop, and his information that he got went down into the TS, and the information from the turret went into the TS, and they produced the answers and transmitted them back, I mean, to the the chap in the foretop, he would have had, he actually controlled the chute. Well, because he could see. This was before the days of radar. Mm. There it is.
You were saying just now, I mean, you became a submariner. Why did you go become a submariner?
I think it was partly due to the fact that you got $5 a day extra pay, and you also got more responsibility when you were young, which we rather liked. And if you were a gunnery officer, you didn't have control of a ship at all. You just controlled the guns, whereas in submarines, you could be captain of a submarine at the age of 23 or something like that, which we rather fancied. And a lot of my friends went into submarines, and I think that had something to do with it. I had a great friend who was my brother-in-law, and we both discussed it and thought we would go into submarines, and we did our courses and everything together. And that's nothing.
Now, to learn to be a submariner, you went down to
Dolphin.
Yes.
And you did a submarine course, which I don't know how long it lasted. But you went to, you were taken to sea in submarine, and they had what they called the training squadron, and the new boys went out for the day, and you learned to escape in the escape hatch. But no, it was just like training for anything else, except you did it in a submarine.
You learned how to control it and how to.
Oh yes.
The ballast tanks. And
that's
the
right.
And
that's right. Oh yes.
What was the name of your first boat that you were sent to when you became qualified?
H-33. They were little things, only about 100,000 tons anyway.
And that was really sailing in home waters, because it was a coastal
site. We were based at Port Dolphin, yes, yes.
The whole base seems to be in the air.
Well, they've been a bit busy, I think, with them.
Anyhow, back to submarines. H-34, you said, was it?
H-33.
33, yes. And you were what, a junior officer in that, I think?
Very junior, yes. Yes.
And then you progressed, what, to a bigger submarine, did you? No?
I then went out to China. And I went to Otis. There were 12 submarines out there, O, P, and R. And there was the Otis was an O. And I was torpedo officer. And
where were you based?
In Hong Kong.
In Hong Kong.
And in the summer, when it got too hot, we went up to Wei Hai Wei, up in the north. That was in the days when the Chinese, the country was run by the warlords. They didn't have any organized government, and each warlord ran his little area. Wei Hai Wei was under one particular warlord, and he didn't mind us a bit, because he demanded his due from the locals, and as long as they paid him, he didn't want to fight. And they,
what was your job there?
In
China, on the China station. What did you have to do?
The Navy.
The Navy itself. I mean, was it to counter the Japanese, or to keep the rule of peace so that merchants could sail? Anti-pirates?
Oh, we had it very much from anti-pirates. The pirates were quite active. In fact, when I was out there, they used to attack the coastal shipping, and on one occasion, David Luce, who eventually became First Sea Lord, he was a submariner, and he was a little bit older than me, and he was captured by the pirates, and they took him away, and we had to pay vast compensation to get him back. So the First Sea Lord was actually captured by the pirates.
And you lived on depot ships all this time, did you?
Oh, yes. Each boat had its cabins.
What was I mean, this is, we're talking about the late 20s, are we now? 28, 29, something like that?
What's
Hong Kong like in those days? A little
fishy. Wonderful, wonderful. I was much better off as a sub-lieutenant in Hong Kong than I was really for the rest of my life, I think. I mean, everything was very cheap. I had a pony, which I used to play polo on. I had a boat, a speed boat, and... It was great. And, of course, I had a Chinese servant who was very good and very loyal.
When you came ashore, was it on Hong Kong Island itself? I mean, where did you play polo? Where was the polo ground?
In the middle of the race course.
Oh.
I was a jockey. I raced in Hong Kong a lot. And the polo field was in the middle of the race course.
And what sort of social life was there out there?
Oh, pretty hectic, pretty hectic.
Were a lot of girls out there, were there, or?
Quite enough. And it was very cheap, very cheap. And of course, Wei Hai Wei was very quiet from that point of view, but there was very good shooting. We used to go duck shooting and snipe shooting, and of course, there were lots of games you could play. But there wasn't much else there. There was the Wei Hai Wei Club, and I think the sailors had rather a dull time. They had down in Hong Kong they had the not canteen, yes, I think it was. But up in Wei Hai Wei there wasn't much. And so I don't think the sailors were keen on it.
I think a lot of them had second families out there, didn't they? I have heard.
What do you mean by second?
Well, they married Chinese wives and set up house.
Oh, I was so innocent, I didn't know. No, I hadn't heard that.
Some of the submariners I have interviewed, this was the case, but...
No, I don't know.
How long were you on the China station for?
I did two spells on the China station. 1932, I think, or 1931, And then I sailed back to England from Hong Kong, and that was took a year, and that was 1933-34.
How did you get a year off? Was it unpaid leave?
Well, I think we were lucky. The CNC in China was Howard Kelly. There were two Kelly admirals, and they fought like anything. And Howard Kelly was the CNC, and he was rather keen on sailing, and we were very lucky because we got support from him, and he had to consult the Admiralty, and we were lucky in that Geoffrey Blake was the Admiral, the Third Sea Lord, I think, and he was a very keen sailor, and he supported us. And so it's just...
Where did you get your boat from? Did you build it? Have it?
Oh, we had it built in Hong Kong. The Hong Kong Wampa Dock Company. And it cost £800 to build. There she is. And she was, 45 feet long or 52 feet overall. And she cost £800.
And how many have you sailed,
then? Five. I've got a picture of them somewhere. Mm-hmm. No, it's not here.
So how did you... You came back, what, through the Suez Canal, did you, or around the Cape?
No, we went east. We went, first of all, to Formosa, Taiwan, and then... to Japan. The Japs were very suspicious of us because we were five naval officers and they couldn't understand what we were doing sailing back when we could have gone back in a P&O, and they didn't seem to think it was... They thought we were up to something, and we used to get followed wherever we went by a detective, a Japanese detective, and... They generally didn't really believe us. This was, well, quite a long time before the war, but
they haven't invaded Manchuria at that time, had they? Or had they?
No, I don't know. I don't know.
Did you carry a radio?
We had a radio, oh yes, we had a receiver. We did have a transmitter, and that didn't seem to work very well. But I was the radio operator, and I could read Morse code at the commercial rate, and we could get our weather forecasts and that sort of thing, which was very useful.
So from Japan you sailed where?
We then went up to the Aleutian Islands. And had a fascinating time up there. Pretty well uninhabited. There was an American sealer, I think he was. He collected the skins of seals and sold them back in America. Otherwise, there were very few people about. And it was quite interesting that it became rather important in the last war, because they had wars up there. And we went all along the Aleutian Islands to I can't remember the name of the end island, and anyhow down to Vancouver in Canada, where we had great fun with the Canadian Navy. And then we went right down the west coast of... Do you want to know the whole trip now?
Well, just an outline of it. Yes. I know a book's been written about it.
Yes, I've got the book there if you want it. No, we went from Vancouver, we went down to Los Angeles, where we were given a tour of the studios, and met all the famous film stars, Fred Astaire, and we actually saw Fred Astaire and, what's the name of his partner?
Ginger Rogers.
Ginger Rogers, yes.
Yeah.
And we saw them being filmed. We went on to the film studios.
Yeah.